This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of What the Hell's That Noise? Welcome to this episode of Herding Code being recorded on March 9th, 2012. This is an open discussion.
is that like an open marriage?
Open always beats closed. Come on now.
I can talk to other people as long as I come back home to you.
Does that mean we have to take pull requests from everyone?
We accept pull requests. We accept pull requests on Twitter.
No, it just means they can fork our conversation and have their own.
I think for a while I had a Creative Commons thing on the bottom of the site, so people could do mashups. Know what they would do.
And yet.
Yeah. And yet, none.
So speaking of pull requests, what did you guys think about the whole GitHub debacle? I mean, there was like two issues that fell out of that. Everyone has a security hole now and then, so that's something I thought that they handled pretty quickly. But then there was the discussion about, you know, is this a Rails problem that should be fixed in Rails? And then there was the suspension of the account of the fellow who demonstrated the exploit on GitHub. What did you guys think about that?
Well, so I had kind of two thoughts on it. The first was that it was kind of a dick move on the guy who exploited it, because, you know, if it is a bug in Rails, then submit a patch. And if it, you know, it sounds like he tried contacting GitHub and they didn't listen to him, or didn't listen fast enough, so he went ahead and did the commit against the Rails master. And, you know, at that point, I'm wondering if he could commit against Rails master, why didn't he just commit a fix, or, you know, approve his own patch that he submitted, or whatever?
Yeah, or as Eric Williams said, he had the opportunity to change the auto CRLF for every single repo, and he didn't take the opportunity. That probably makes people most upset.
Yes. And the second thing was that now poor coding practices have a new name, mass assignment, which is, so now, oh, MVC has a security hole. Rails has a security hole. Well, you know, sure. But it's a poor coding practice. Is that a security hole? Only if you follow it. Why are you reusing your, you know, models that, you know, why are you using models that have properties that you don't want set? I don't know. That was annoying to me.
And if any listeners didn't know about it, it was basically the bug where you put whatever you want inside of a form post, and the equivalent of a model binder in Rails will just happily move all of that information into whatever object that you wanted it moved into, even if you didn't expect something like an isAdmin flag.
And you can do this in, I mean, you can do it in ASP.NET MVC. I mean, you can, which is a good reason why a lot of people were saying, well, I always use view models, you know, and then you get away from that problem because you're not binding directly to what's passed in.
One thing I wasn't clear on was, I know he reported it as a Rails bug. Had he also reported it to GitHub?
My understanding was that he reported it to Rails, and he's like, look, this is a problem with Rails. And then Rails didn't do anything about, or closed his issue. And so he's like, well, fine, Rails runs on GitHub, I'll just mess with the Rails repo. You know, so I mean, GitHub was almost kind of tangential. It just happened to be that the Rails project is on GitHub and the vulnerability was in Rails.
Right. So that makes it a bit more dickish to me. He didn't port it to GitHub before he used them. That's fairly uncool.
I mean, my thought with this, you know, a lot of people were like, oh, they should hire him, and what choice did he have, and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, there are, like, computer security, this stuff happens all the time and has been happening for decades, right? And there are non-dickish ways of solving these problems without, like, well, I had no choice, I screwed with the repo, you know? And so it's like, on Twitter, I linked to the OWASP. They have, like, a standard way of, here's what you do when you see security problems, you know? And, you know, I mean, there are ways of doing it. So I think you know, publish a thing and you say, look, there's a security issue here. And, you know, I will in 1 week or whatever, I will publish this thing, you know, and send things out internally. I mean, there are better ways of handling this stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just the fact that it's If it was in like Windows or OS X or something that was closed source and didn't have a history of accepting patches, then it'd be one thing to be, I got to demonstrate this in the wild. But when it's open source and you go and you mess with someone's site who's unrelated, at, you know, just because someone didn't like your fix and you didn't, you know, you could have said, he could have written a huge blog post about how it is, what the fix is in Rails, submitted a patch and put the onus back on Rails. The Rails, you know, devs to say, okay, we didn't take it because of blah or X, or we just don't like the guy, or we've got a better fix coming. But, you know, it just didn't make any sense to go and mess with someone's repo instead of actually submitting the fix or, you know, publicizing the fix.
So what would you guys do if this was your framework? You know, if you were the benevolent dictator of the framework where this problem slash bug, however you want to describe it, would you set it so that the default is that you don't bind anything unless it's explicit? It sounded like, Scott, it sounded like you were saying, no, it's up to the developer to make the right choices.
Yeah, I think because having that kind of auto-binding is useful, provided that you're not getting input directly from the web. And that's where I talk about it being a poor coding practice, is you don't just blindly accept user content. You don't do it for, you know, HTML sanitization reasons, for cross-site scripting, for database injection, SQL injection, all that stuff. But in this case, for some reason, everyone thinks that the default, or it's safe to just go ahead and bind directly to entities that are going to be, you know, put in the database, because they have this illusion that it's okay and secure, or they're just a little bit too steeped in the don't repeat yourself mantra. Like, well, I have a user model. I have to use it for everything, even if it includes properties that shouldn't be set on certain people or shouldn't be available through certain interfaces. Like if the isAdmin bit in this particular case was only available when you are editing a user and you are the admin of the repo or the Rails site, then it makes sense to have the isAdmin bit available to be set. But if you're just a Joe user, you wouldn't necessarily, you know, if you're just editing your, you shouldn't be able to set yourself as admin through the regular edit user interface. And that's what I said. You just don't accept user input without looking at it. And so would I just do it through a whitelist? Probably not. I would just reinforce it as a you know, best practice. You know, don't use your database entities directly from your UI.
Brad Wilson.
But all Rails apps do that. I mean, that's the Rails way.
I think it's pretty common in MVC, honestly, too. ASP.NET MVC. I mean, and I think a lot of it's people just don't think about it. They're like, they don't think about like how the binding works. And it's like, okay, this worked. I posted the form back and it went into my database. It must be good. Brad Wilson had a good post on this where he talked through, it's called input validation versus model validation in ASP.NET MVC. And he talks about using the bind attribute, and that is the whitelist approach. But yeah, I would agree, Scott Kuhn, I think it's smarter to just separate out, you know, view models are for display only.
And I think about the alternative, and the alternative would be to try to be safe by default. And then I start thinking about my experience with IIS over the years. It used to be so easy to get something running on a Windows server. You install IIS, you plop some bits down, everything just works. Nowadays, when everything is off by default and you have to go in and figure out every little sub feature that you need turned on, it's just a huge pain.
It's also, it is hard to see if something's not working. It's hard to understand why, you know, like, okay, I posted this thing and nothing happened, or, you know, like on a, like you're saying with IIS, okay, I did this thing and I get a 404, but the file's there, what's going on, you know? And it's like, I mean, I would think, you know, maybe even have some like, you know, setting or some kind of warning or something, but it is just really tricky when there's no knowledge of why it's not doing what you think it should do. Like, it's hard to debug a negative case.
See, I would argue the opposite case here is the opposite side, which is, especially when it comes to this kind of security stuff, it's so easy to get this wrong that everything that the framework can do to help you be secure by default, it should do. And it's similar to me to the whole, you know, auto encoding of output. You know, for a long time, few engines didn't auto encode output. And you could make the same argument. Well, a smart developer should know that you should always auto, you know, you should always encode when you're outputting user data. But it's just so easy to miss. And so, and in the Rails case, I think there are other approaches that the framework can, you know, do to help. Like I know that Yehuda Katz wrote up a whole proposal for, like, you know, how do we safely do mass assignment for Rails? And I don't remember the details of it, but I mean, I think they're looking at that. And I think the framework should try to help you that kind of stuff, especially with when you're talking about security.
Yeah, I could go either way really on it. I mean, I can see actually a combination of the two. So making it kind of safe by default. I think Phil Hackett made a point on Twitter about how many people argued about JSON GET being on by default or off by default. I forget.
Off by default, yeah.
Yeah, off by default. And I could see, you know, arguments either way. You turn it off and then you give guidance. But there's just so much, at least in terms of MVC and Rails, so much guidance out there that just shows the simple case, oh, just let the binder handle everything. You know, you don't really think about it. And I've never run into this because I always end up with a view model that has like a composition of several different, you know, models or properties on it. And then I use something like AutoMapper to map them over. And I don't get, you know, extra things put in because they're just not there. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's really the problem is that, so if you send even a form post to an MVC controller, it's one thing if you are using the model as the parameter on the controller method versus using individual properties as the parameters on the method. So if you're using the individual parameters and you get an extra one, it's just going to be ignored. But if you're using the model and it's present on the model, then it'll be bound and set and whatnot.
Yeah, or even, you know, like that Brad Wilson's post I was talking about earlier, he's got an example where you've got a blog post and then you've got another comment, you know, you've got a list of comments and it's possible to, you know, post one thing when you didn't think, like, say I'm updating a comment, well, I can, if I know what the IDs are or whatever, I could post to the comment. I could change what the post was as part of updating a comment. You know what I mean by linked entities? And so...
Software is hard.
Yep.
Let's go shopping. who's going to buy the new iPad?
Which one? The iPad 3 or the iPad HD?
The new.
The
it's
new
just new.
I get confused. So this actually does seem a little bit more... like a something I would buy if I was going to get one, just because. Well, the MacBook Air is going to come first, but I like the idea that they just bumped up the resolution to plaid on this thing.
It's insane.
I was reading the transcript of one of the live blogs of the event, and he said, "Well, we have a problem. Is that our iPad resolution is greater than the screen that we're showing this on, so we can't actually demo it."
Yeah, this is one of those things that I definitely want, but I'm trying to resist just because I don't have any income right now. But, you know, when I see one, I'm sure it will make me drool. I haven't actually seen that awesome screen yet. Maybe it's best that I avoid it, but I'm really curious about it.
It was interesting. They were pointing out the whole DPI thing is actually different on the iPads versus the iPhones. And the whole explanation, I mean, I'm watching via live blog, so I don't really know what they said. It could have been speaking in Portuguese, but the general idea was that, you know, the farther away your eyes are, the whole point is that Retina makes it so that you don't see the pixels, right? So they're saying, okay, you hold iPads farther away from your face than you hold a phone. So my solution is I'm just going to get standard definition display monitors, and then I'll sit maybe 6 feet away from my desk. And I think I'm going to get the same result.
Patent pending.
Well, so this is kind of the dilemma with Apple stuff is that the technology gets better, but the price points stay the same pretty much. I mean, you know, you'll get variations of $100 or $200, but, you know, the next line of iPads is going to cost about the same, but, you know, the technology will have, you know, gotten better. And so it's just a matter of when do you want to take the hit on being obsolete? You know, is this resolution with the camera a good, you know, starting point? Or should we wait for the next one when it's got a faster processor and, I don't know, wings or something on it?
And now you don't even have to worry about the version numbers because it's always just going to be new.
Right. And that's the same thing they did with the MacBook and MacBook Pros. And once they switched to that, you know, you just have MacBooks and MacBook Pros and MacBook Airs. You don't have MacBook, you know, Air 23. Because you try to talk to people about what laptop they have in the Windows world, and you get into all these weird model numbers and WZX 4500Z and trying to go find RAM for it. And like, oh, no, wait, I've got... you know, I've got the DV5000Z, not the H, and it has a different level of RAM cache on it. So I need to get something different than your DV5000D D, something crazy like that.
Well, see, the thing with Apple products, the key with Apple products is you have to buy them exactly when they're released, because you know a year from now it's going to be obsolete. So you got to get that maximal usage before you hate your product and want to get the new one.
I wonder, you know, there is definitely a trickle-down thing where, like, if you're price sensitive and you don't mind being a few years behind, then, like, for instance, I've been using this Asus ZenBook, and it's not a MacBook Air, but it's pretty nice, and a lot of people that look at it, you know, that have MacBook Airs are like, it's pretty similar, you know? It's like a lot of things do trickle down over time. I wonder about displays, you know, if we'll see that or if they're just... I've read some things about, like, the way that Apple's scaled up and that they've bought things like aluminum and processing, and they've got, you know, chip manufacturers, like, scheduled out for a long time. So it is kind of prohibitive for other people to jump in.
Yeah, their supply chain management is one of their huge advantages. Like, they do it better than anybody. So it wouldn't surprise me if they ate up all high-resolution screens.
They bought all the pixels.
Exactly. They the world own is all out of pixels. All your pixels belong to us.
That doesn't even get into the whole patent thing, too. I mean, like, I
right.
It hasn't really affected anything I've cared about, but there's all these rumblings all the time about, you know, injunction in Australia, you know, somebody can't sell something. Now in China, somebody, you know, now in Europe, and then they get overturned in a month or so. But it is scary. Like, everybody's suing everybody, and we just kind of all hope it all works out.
Yes, or we reach patent Armageddon, yeah. Where essentially nobody can release any new products ever again.
Back to the Stone Age.
But I have to say, Apple is like the one technology company right now that can actually make me lust after their products. You know what I mean? Like nobody else has that effect right now. Hmm. MacBook Air, the iPad, and those are the new iPhone. Like every year, I don't buy them every year, but every year I want them. And that in previous, you know, in the past has not been true.
The original the Kindle 2 was like that for me, kind of. I mean, it was kind of like, I don't know. It was wild and it was something I definitely wanted.
So you've never had, Kevin, a Samsung phone user laugh at you while you stand in line for your Apple product?
They can't laugh at him anymore because he's got a 4G phone.
Oh, that's true.
No, I don't. I think only the 4S's qualify. I don't have 4S.
What's the deal with that? They like got a software upgrade and now they report themselves as 4G?
Yeah. Well, the 4S had a, I don't remember what they call it, HSDPA Plus or something. It was a higher throughput 3G. And, you know, old-fashioned 3G. And apparently, in a total weasel marketing move, AT&T decided to label that 4G, which is
brilliant.
Ridiculous.
Well, all right. We had Twitter questions, a couple Twitter questions. One here was about what good JavaScript libraries people are using these days. What are you using these days, Kevin?
Like client-side libraries?
It just says libraries, so maybe anything.
I'm doing JavaScript on the server and the client these days, so... Well, I'm doing a lot of Backbone stuff. Big fan of Backbone.
Mm.
For testing, I've been using a test framework called Mocha, which I'm quite fond of. That works on both the client and the server. Underscore goes along with Backbone. They kind of work together.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, jQuery plugins here or there. But that's kind of the core of what I'm using these days.
What is it that you like about Mocha compared to the 15 bazillion other
right. There? Well, it uses the Jasmine style... It has multiple sort of what they call UIs, which is the way you write your tests. You can write them sort of QUnit style, or you can write them what they call BDD style, which is Jasmine style, and or RSpec style, depending on who you want to talk to. So you have describe and it and before each. And it works on both the client and the server, which I really like. It has nice async support, which is good for doing node testing. It's like super easy to do async testing. And it has sort of continuous testing support where you can have it watch for changes to the file and automatically kick off the tests if your test script changes. So it's quite nice.
Cool. Anyone else have any libraries to throw in there?
I haven't been doing very much JavaScript lately, honestly. One thing that's been kind of cool that I was using was the single page application stuff that's in MVC4. It had Knockout in there, but it's also got this Upshot library that does communication client to server. So, and I'm sure there's all kinds of overlap with some of the things Kevin was talking about there. For small, you know, hello world kind of stuff, it was really nice. I haven't used it in anything big yet, though.
Cool. Some of the libraries I was playing around with recently were all related to doing transformations in it with CSS and script. So libraries like Sylvester, which is does all the matrix math for you, dot products and things like that. And then the really interesting one I thought was one, I'm not even sure how you pronounce it, but it's Zoomooze, like Zoom and then O-O-Z, Zoomooze.js, that will basically allow you to zoom to any element in the DOM. And even if that element is rotated and so forth, it will adjust the viewport so that it comes in right side up. So if you've ever done something like, if you've ever looked at one of these Prezi presentations, P-R-E-Z-I, where you can zoom around, you can kind of get that effect with Zoomooze, Zoomaz, Zoom O-O-Z. Not sure how you say it.
I think it's spelled out.
And then, well, there's an impress.js too that will do the same thing as Prezi, but actually take advantage of the 3D transformations that you can do with CSS, so it can actually move in the Z-axis too.
I'm curious if you guys have looked into like Zepto or some of these other jQuery, you know, like micro jQuery libraries.
Not Zepto specifically, but I've looked at a few, and I like the idea, like especially around Ender and kind of a different approach to the module pattern and being able to load up, you know, individual things like that. Or
what was the name of that one?
I can't remember. There was Ender.js. Okay. Yeah, and then he's got a bunch of it's by Dustin Diaz. I think his GitHub repo is /DED, but I wouldn't swear to it. Anyway, if you look for Ender.js, you can see there's a bunch of others. Like he's got a micro library for handling requests or checking cookies and things like that. So instead of kind of throwing it all into one huge library, that's the basic idea is you break out this functionality to smaller libraries. So if you don't have to deal with cookies on the page, you just don't load up the cookie library. And Yahoo's been doing that for a long time with their YUI loader, where you can set dependencies between things. And so if you specify, hey, I want the data table, it knows it needs to get like the Ajax stuff and other dependencies and bring them in. But yeah, there's a website, microjs.com, I think, or microjs.org, that got thrown up a while back. And it had an interesting community model where it was just it was another one of those websites hosted on GitHub. So you could just fork it and add your own micro library in that you've written. And then push it back, and it'd be listed on there.
Wow, there's quite a few here now.
Yeah, I think I've got one on there, and there's some others that looked really interesting. But it was nice that they kind of said it has to be under this when compressed and minified.
Yeah, I'm trying to look here real quick. It looks like Backbone is on here, and that's the largest one at 5.3 kilobyte.
You know, this reminds me, too, a lot of these libraries are harder. Well, like one argument for using jQuery, even though it's bigger, is because it's on the CDNs and all that. But I've been using CDN.js a bit lately, and they have, it's like a second-tier CDN for smaller JavaScript libraries. So, like, for instance, I sent in a pull request to get Google Prettify put up there, and they put it on pretty quickly for me. And so it's the same kind of model. You send a pull request with, you package up a JavaScript library using the, I forget what the common format for, like, JavaScript-based packages. And they put them up, and then it's a nice CDN-hosted, you know, thing for JavaScript libraries. And they're starting one up, I think. I'm not sure what the status is. Last I checked, it wasn't up yet, but it was CDN CSS. And the idea was, you know, common CSS libraries for everyone not using Twitter Bootstrap. They can, you know, use these other CSS libraries.
The whole Zepto thing is kind of interesting because I see it referenced a lot more these days as a lightweight replacement for jQuery, especially in the mobile space. So like recently I threw a couple of open source projects up on GitHub that were some JavaScript testing libraries. And I went through and made sure that they worked with Zepto as well as jQuery. And I see that a fair amount these days, you know, requires jQuery and or Zepto. So it definitely seems to be getting some traction out there.
Well, I think the main thing to remember about Zepto is, if I'm thinking of the correct one, the one by the Scriptaculous guy, Thomas Fuchs.
Yeah.
Is that he's mainly targeting mobile WebKit. So So it doesn't hit, you know, some of the other mobile browsers or even some of the mainstream desktop browsers. But his whole idea was he wanted to have a small micro framework that would work on iPhones, basically. iPhones and Android, depending on, you know, how up-to-date their Android OS is.
Kevin, was it difficult for you to make sure that it worked on Zepto? Did you have to do anything special?
No, for the most part, it just worked. There was only one tricky bit where there was some code that was... It was checking what the instance of the dollar sign was for some reason. I can't remember what it was. And so in jQuery, you can say, you know, dollar sign instance of jQuery, and that works. And that didn't work with Zepto. And I had to figure out a little hacky backdoor way of figuring that out. But that was the only thing. Everything else pretty much just worked.
So should we talk about exactly how you start down or shut down Windows 8?
Sure.
Because there seem to be about 40 different ways, and none of them are listed on the Metro screen or in the desktop screen. I mean, everyone says just, you know, type power. And I don't know if that's discoverable. I mean, when confronted with an unknown UI, mm-hmm. do you just start randomly typing words and letters to see if it works?
Well,
I try to get to a command prompt as quickly as possible.
Shut down slash yes, something or other.
Shut down dash R.
Well, I think that Jeff Atwood had a blog post about this years ago when Vista was still coming out, and it was like, you search for everything. And I've pretty much converted to doing that for pretty much everything. Like, I don't use my mouse for finding programs or finding, you know, files or anything. I just hit the window key and type something, and most of the time it works, including settings and stuff like that. It's not...
But now in Metro, if you hit the Windows key and you're in the Metro app, it takes you to desktop mode and vice versa.
So if you're... Well, I've got Windows on my desk, but if you're in Metro already, just type. If not, hit the window key and then type power or shutdown or whatever. But I'll agree, it is... I guess...
That's such a power user thing to do, though. Like, that is not...
Yeah.
That is not what grandma's doing.
Well, so I think, and I can't really speak for what's on anyone's minds, and I'm sure this is consumer preview, and if it's blowing everyone...
John, you represent all of Microsoft.
Right. Well...
You have a lot to answer for.
I think the idea is that people are just going to hit the power button. Like, if you want to turn off power, you'll hit power.
Right, but that goes against
any modern computer.
15, 20 years of training that they've had on Windows, where you're always taught, at least since 95, you hit the start button, then you go to power off and shut down. Otherwise, Windows will flip out and it'll pop up. Next time you restart, you'll get the check disk and the blue screen and yada, yada, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
and you also always go to the system tray to properly disconnect all USB devices.
Yes, because otherwise they might... You know, I don't know, turn into octopus or something.
It's crazy. I mean, all modern computers for the past, I don't know how long, have had, like, if you hit the power button, they won't really disastrously, like, shut down immediately and kill your hard drive. Like, they'll do something intelligent, usually.
Yeah, they go to sleep.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the idea is that people will, and I don't know, what do you do on a Mac? Do people power down all the time, and do you...
They close their lid.
Yeah, right. So
yeah, usually just close the lid and it goes to sleep.
So I think that's the idea with Windows 8 as well. Is like, okay, if you need to power down, you can, but you know, stop worrying about that. Maybe. But I agree. I think there's a lot of like the answer to so many things is like, well, you just do this thing. You mouse in the corner and something happens. And there's all these new gestures and things, and it's. Like the last time something like this happened was like Windows 95, you know, it was like, oh, wow. You know, we've now got this whole completely different paradigm for everything.
Yeah.
How much of this is that? I mean, you know, they're clearly targeting this as one of their platforms as being a tablet platform, a la an iPad competitor. So, you know, in that case, you know, you don't shut down your tablet. You push the button and it goes to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but I wonder if they've gone too far that way, you know, and have sort of neglected some of the desktop-isms that people expect. I don't know. I haven't played around with it yet, so I don't.
I've played with it, but it's been on a laptop. And it's actually, I've got this laptop that I've completely hated for the past 2 years, and now it's finally getting some use because it's a touch screen and it's multi-touch. And it's been kind of a dog on Windows 7. But on Windows 8, it's kind of cool. And actually, like, my wife and kids have been stealing it away from me, and they have some cool touch, like, games. that my 4-year-old figured out, and she's like hopping between all. So like as a tablet, it actually seems pretty smooth. I think a lot personally, like the transition between the two worlds is strange. It's like you're running a VM. You know what I mean? It's a little confusing. Mm-hmm.
You mean when you go from the desktop to the tiles?
Yeah.
Yes.
I do.
It's odd.
So at first I was kind of like, I don't know what's going on with this. It seems crazy. And then I read one of those enormous blog posts on the Sinofsky blog. And he wrote like about, building Windows 8. And it was like the whole, this is the start menu reimagined. And so then I was like, okay, Metro, you can kind of think of Metro as a better start menu. And it's got search built in and all that. So you don't really need to click on a start button. You're already there.
It feels to me like there's the team that works on the tiles and there's the team that works on the desktop, and they only meet about once a month in some war room to argue about things, and they never really figure out how they can actually make these two things work together.
Yeah, I think this and also like Visual Studio, which is a whole nother thing to talk about. But like when people do, if enough people say, I can't find out how to shut down my computer, like somebody somewhere does actually read that stuff.
Yeah, so Visual Studio is another new one. What do you guys think about the all caps and the gray look that it has now? Has anyone else tried it besides John?
I have. It's interesting. The only thing that annoys me about it is that it's not themable yet. So you can go in there, you can select light or dark, but you can't input your own theme in there. You go in, you change fonts and colors and whatnot, it just affects the editor, which means that my hot dog theme settings are not as effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a deal breaker. Yeah. And I've been hanging out in that Code 52 chat room on Jabber, and Paul went in and like was doing all this crazy resource hacking, and he was able to change some of the icon colors, but not enough. Like he said, some were accessible and some weren't, but he was like on a mission to recolor it himself. And there've been some interesting, there was on User Voice, somebody had been doing a whole, like more of a Metro look to it. And there's been a range of those. There was like, Scott Barnes was doing some that were like completely Metro with, in my opinion, way too much white space. And, you know, it was kind of like it was nice looking, but I couldn't imagine coding in it. And then there was somebody else, and I forget his name, but he was on User Voice and he was doing a whole, whole bunch of revamps of it, bringing in some color. I thought, like, if I was doing this, I would do, the contrast is a little bit weird to me. Like in the light theme, it's okay, but there's no color, and so it's a little hard to find the icons. I like the dark theme better, and I was actually kind of happy with it until Brad Wilson pointed out to me that the white icons really stand out against the black background, and now I can't, like, I can't take my eye off it, and they, like, drive me nuts. So
thanks, Brad.
Yeah, I know. I was happy.
I can never unsee that.
When's the last time Kevin opened Visual Studio?
I do not know.
The day you walked out of your office.
Been a while.
I had
to rebuild my machine because Windows updated the new machine for me, and I have not installed it yet.
We need Windows anytime. There's some joke in there.
But I did look at the screenshots, and I did the blog post. I can't say my initial reaction was not favorable. And especially the screaming caps, like, drives me bonkers. And the, just the absolute colorlessness of it doesn't speak to me.
Those are obviously, like, the things that are going to get everyone's attention. There's a lot of stuff in there that I found, like, it does seem a lot faster to me.
Well, that's big, because, like, the one thing I have wanted out of the last 5 versions of Visual Studio is just be faster.
Mm-hmm.
It's so slow.
So they've done a lot of stuff that's like, man, I'm completely... I started something talking about what was updated in Visual Studio with the word so. How Microsofty can I get? But they did a lot of stuff. I watched something at like TechEd from a year ago, and they did a lot of stuff to make it multi-core and make things not block and get rid of those, like, Visual Studio is busy. Like, what am I? You know, I'm kind of busy over here too. In general, I'm finding, like, it starts up faster and it's, you know, quick to get around in. And then two other things I like is they put search pretty much everywhere. So, like, on the main screen in the upper right corner, you can type, instead of going all over the place to find things, you can just type in, you know, font size. And
you're talking about the quick launch.
Yeah.
Up at the upper right hand. Yeah. Yep.
So
that kind of threw me off because I thought it was going to be like kind of act like a Google box.
Mm-hmm.
So I like put my cursor on a type in the editor. So I had var, or I had a foo, my foo equals null. And I was like, okay, I want to find the definition for foo. So I put the cursor on foo, I went up to the quick launch and typed in foo, and it said no results found. And I thought, what? Oh, wait, this must be something different.
Yeah.
And it threw me off for a second there. But now that I see what it is, it makes a little bit more sense. But I'm also wondering how accessible that's going to be. I guess if you have to make a search function so that you can find things in your menu, maybe you've got too damn much in your menu.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, there's so many different people using this for so many different things, you know? So like some people are doing just web development, and so like I'll find that there are things where I'm like, well, get rid of all this stuff. And then I talk to other people that are doing all WPF or all, you know, and it's like there's so many different.
Well, that's their own fault.
So, but like as an example, as we were talking, I just clicked in there and then I typed in font size. And so instead of having to go through all the menu stuff to find out how to change my font size, it immediately shows environment, fonts, and colors, and I click on that, and it takes me to the thing. I agree. I mean, in general, this is really unpopular, and I've never talked to anyone that agrees with me, but I wouldn't have minded using ribbons in Visual Studio, but the minimized style, you know, like, I know, but in Word or anything else, you can minimize the ribbons. And so they look like a menu, but you still get all the shortcuts and they're all contextualized. So, I mean, then if you're working in, like, if I'm editing C# code, do I really need a SQL menu or an architecture menu showing up at the top? Like, that just, you know, maybe only show the SQL menu when I'm working on database stuff.
Well, the whole original point of the ribbon was to take apps like the Office apps that have tons and tons of commands and make those commands or surface those commands more effectively to the user.
Mm-hmm.
Like what app has more commands than Visual Studio?
Exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, I kind of get that too.
Well, so I had a different take on that. I mean, I like that it certainly does start up a lot faster. And the main thing is, for me, is projects load faster now. And the fact that you can round trip between version 2010, 2011, projects and solution files. But, you know, don't get me started on project solution file. But it's still, like when I install it in a VM, no plugins, no crazy crap, just, you know, and there's certainly no options because God knows there's no option in the Visual Studio 11 installer for not selecting things. You get the whole shebang or nothing. Startup, private memory use in Task Manager shows at 121 megs. I start up like WebStorm or IntelliJ or RubyMine, something that's based on IntelliJ, and it's right around 70 to 80 megs. And then at the other end of the spectrum, I start up Vim and it starts at 4 megs and pretty much never gets above like 5 megs. And so when people tell me that, you know, oh, Visual Studio slimmed down, all that stuff that you guys complain about, like the architecture menu and all that, that stuff doesn't get loaded until you actually use it. Like, well, then there's 120 megs of crap in there then that I certainly don't want. How can I get rid of all that stuff?
Does it have an impact on you, though? I mean, like now that, you know, everybody's got 4 gigs or more of RAM. I mean.
Well, sure, because it's 120 megs of RAM sitting in a space that can only get 2 gigs worth of virtual memory assigned to it because it's still a 32-bit process, right? And if I understand correctly, you can't assign more than 2 gigs of virtual memory to a 32-bit process, even if you're running on a 64-meg machine, right?
Let me see.
So it's...
Yeah. So, but...
You smarter guys, yeah?
Somebody smart.
So, yeah. So, I mean, that's cutting into the amount of stuff that I have right there.
And that's
depending on what else I have.
That's 120 megs minimum, basically, right?
Right.
That's no project loaded. No plugins that are, you know, air quote, essential, like ReSharper or CodeRush.
Right.
And I would regularly have, you know, 3, 4, or 5 solutions open in separate instances of Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I'll, you know, the most I've ever seen was I had a gig and a half in one instance of Dev ENV. And, you know, routinely it's around 700 or so. And that's with my projects aren't that, my solution files at least aren't that big. They're like, you know, the largest number of projects I've ever had in a solution file in my career to date has been 15. I wouldn't consider, you know, that a large number of projects.
No. Yeah, I don't know. I used to run into this more when I use VMs with larger projects, you know, and then it was like, well, I need multiple gigabytes just to get by. But that was like Visual Studio 2005 days.
So to kind of go back to your question, you know, how much does that really affect you? Well, I don't know that the amount of RAM that it's taking up really affects me, but something's slow in there. I don't know if it's the fact that there's a lot of RAM, or I think on the Visual Studio blog, they talked about going in and profiling and you know, trying to look for areas where performance could be improved. And they found out they were loading 800 DLLs at any one point, given point. Like 800 DLLs, that's an awful lot of Ion knowns floating around and flinging and iDispatching and stuff. You know, my knowledge of COM is limited to that active understanding ActiveX and Olay book I read back in the, you know, early 90s. But surely that can't be a good thing for performance. So maybe it's not the fact that it's taken up a lot of RAM. It's the fact that it's not using the RAM properly, maybe, that makes it slow. I don't know. How's that for FUD?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a direct relation to between. I mean, some like I've had Chrome take up, you know, when I get tons and tons of tabs open. Sure, it takes a lot of memory, but it's still fast. So I don't know if there's a direct relationship between memory use and speed, although I can see that it, you know, yeah, it would make you suspicious. I have seen overall Visual Studio 11 does seem a lot faster when I've been using it, but yeah, I don't know.
Well, they dropped the macro recorder.
That's sad.
What? You're kidding me. I use that all.
No.
Crap, that was my number one used tool when I had to TFS stuff.
I actually just used it recently. I ran through, because I was doing this Code 52 Karnak thing where it would show your keystrokes as you typed them, kind of like Roy Oshirov's Keyboard Jedi, like that kind of idea. And so I wanted it to have the Visual Studio command, like it would know. So if you hit, you know, whatever, Alt F11, it would say, you know, full screen, or you know, Control Alt Shift Backspace, you know, whatever that is. And so I wrote a little macro and output it to YAML. So I'm writing a macro to output YAML. and it had all the shortcuts, and then it loads them in. It all worked, but it was crazy.
That's cool.
So there's no install options anymore?
There's
a user voice saying, let us not install things.
Mm-hmm. So you'll,
like, I don't need dot.
You'll take your crystal reports and like it?
Yeah.
That's right. You can .fuscate your crystal reports. I've never needed either of those projects. And yet, now I have to have them, I guess.
The one that bugs me is the C++, because yeah, it's a big install.
It's big.
And also the servicing then, like, or whatever they call it. I think it is called servicing, where, like, every time you install any service packs or whatever, it takes forever. I remember reading on Heath Stewart's blog years and years ago that it was like, if you want your service packs to install slower and you want to have fewer Windows updates and all that, don't install stuff you don't use. So, that user voice thing's got 334 votes as I look now, and it says it's under review. But, yeah. And there's both the, like, you know, just cutting down on updates for things you don't use and all that. But then also, as people are pointing out on that user voice thing, that, you know, as now people are moving to SSDs, they really do care. Like, if you've got 120 gigs of space, you don't want to be filling up 6 of it with stuff you're not using.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the one that gets me, because, you know, I guess we have to have C++ to do Metro, right? Yeah, whatever. Is the Office tools for developers. I don't want to write Office stuff, and I don't have to. So why would I want it in there? So that should be separate. That shouldn't even be bundled with Visual Studio.
Yeah.
But I digress on the point.
The thing on user voice, they say that, you know, based on usage, they found only 10% of customers chose to customize their installations. And of those, there wasn't a consensus of which packages to install or not install. So at least for the beta.
Oh, that's always such crap.
I know. And
anytime you ask the team anything, they'll say, oh, well, we talked to a select group of 30 people. And
right.
20% of them said that only 80% of the time do they ever use the return key.
Yeah.
And you're like, what is that? Because they always use that as a justification.
Right.
they always use that as a justification for not doing stuff, but then they'll put in other crazy crap that only 1% of their people use. You're like, well, how come this stupid edge case got in, but my stupid edge case didn't?
Yeah.
So I don't even bother asking anymore.
Well, I think this is based on actual like usage stats, like, you know, where it tracks you, what you do. But still, I mean...
Oh, they always are.
but still, I totally agree. And I think this is good that this is one of the top voted or whatever hot items on User Voice. I do hope that those customization things come in. You know, I mean, this is still just the beta, so...
Maybe it's just that the development team said, you know, this install crap is way too freaking hard. I'm tired of Microsoft installer. Take everything.
Click once.
Too bad. We don't want to write MSI code anymore.
I'm just amusing myself by reading through the User Voice now, looking at some of the suggestions.
If you want to amuse yourself, go to the one that says, bring color into Visual Studio.
Well, I like the one that said, we just want to be able to rename projects in TFS. And someone from the team said that was going to be difficult.
Hmm.
Sorry.
I like going back to my old Kinect bug reports from like Visual Studio 2005 and seeing if any of them actually get fixed.
You've got so many of them up there. Pretty much anything I ever start to put up, it's like, oh, there's a Kevin one from like 8 years ago.
And they don't get fixed.
Oh, wow.
Hmm. Yeah, pretty soon they'll have the Kevin Dente Memorial Kinect site up there. Kevin moved on to Rails and Node development because he never got his bugs fixed. What else we got to talk about? We can only harp against Visual Studio for so long.
You know, this is completely unrelated, and I mean absolutely, but we were talking earlier about Retina display and like what your eye can visually take in and stuff. And there was a cool post that I saw some people link to this past week on ZIPH.org, X-I-P-H, which is the guys that make Aug Vorbis. All of whom, if they need a marketing brand that comes up with some better names, I think. But this post was about 24-bit 192 kilohertz format. I guess it was because it was on the iTunes store, but he was like very carefully dissects how your ear can only hear certain things, and this is just like not of any use. Did you guys see that? Do you know what I'm talking about? No.
No, and we think you're crazy. Oh. Yeah, I saw it.
I didn't see that.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was just really, so he points out like that, you know, these are the edges of your hearing and talks about like how, you know, you always see with sampling, you see these stair step patterns and you think that, you know, we need better resolution to make it sound better. But he said actually like with a digital analog conversion that doesn't even exist. Maybe this is all boring. I care about this stuff. Audio.
Hey. And that's why you edit the podcast.
So are we going to encode the Herding Code podcast?
Yes.
Like this?
Well, I've given like the .NET Rocks and Scott Hanselman grief about the size of their podcast because like the release is like 70 megs for a 20-minute show. And, you know, you go look at something like This American Life, which is professionally produced in a radio studio, and their, you know, download is like, you know, 10 megs or mm-hmm. something. And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, why are you encoding it at such a high rate? Oh, well, I can hear the artifacts and I can hear this and the hiss. And I'm like, no, you can't. it's really all about the input. It's not about how you encode stuff. If you have a really clean input and you record it correctly, you can record at a much lower bit rate. You don't need to be, you know, 254, you know, bits to have a good sound. That's not going to help you if your input is crap. And I think that's why that. You know, the professional radio shows, the Discovery podcasts and TLCs all sound really good because they've got professional recording equipment mm-hmm. and they can, you know, so at that point, doesn't matter how much they compress it. Just the same as if, you know, I'm on my netbook in the middle of a hailstorm on, you know, 3G or you know, AT&T E network connection. It's not going to sound great no matter how much you encode it. It'll just sound like crap at, you know, 196. You know, K-bits.
Yeah, that is funny. It's I kind of balanced out. I think I do these now at like 96 kilobits, but it's like like you're saying, it is all about microphones. And I actually did use, like, I have a nicer microphone for audio stuff, and I use it for screencasts sometimes. And it sounded silly, I thought, the few podcasts I used it, because, like, I would be like, hello, speaking to you from, you know, and then, like, everybody else just sounds like normal people. And the guests might be calling up from their laptop microphone, you know, it just like sounded all out of place. So
it's the voice of God and squeaky.
Right, exactly. So, but yeah, with vocal, you know, normal vocals on mono, like you're really not going to hear a difference, you know, between that and like, you know, an enormous file. Well, what have you guys been up to lately? Okay, Scott, you're flying all over the place.
Yeah, well, the spring usually is that time of year where there's a few conferences to go to. And other than that, I've had some training gigs. And then I'm also one of the clients that I work with a lot, really interesting project I've been working on that's using Ruby and Mongo on the back end and ASP.NET MVC on the for the presentation layer. And that's been kind of fun.
Interesting. I would sort of expect the opposite.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of reversed, but it's fun.
So we'll be expecting your leaving .NET blog post anytime then.
Yeah.
Now that you've been infected.
Infected, yeah. And a ton of JavaScript stuff I'm doing. And I'll be at I have a Dev Week conference in London and the Software Passion Summit in Sweden coming up.
Nice. I've been doing MVC release stuff, web API and MVC 4 beta and all that. So I was doing screencasts and then in my spare time I keep hacking on these Code 52 projects. I've been doing WPF some lately, and then last night I was working on this Pretzel, which is like Jekyll for .NET. So it supports Liquid and Razor. So I was like fixing up the test for that. So that's fun to like be jumping around a bit more lately.
Mm-hmm.
It's neat.
I haven't been doing much. I just work.
Well, you spoke at that Node PDX thing. I thought that was cool. Your presentation on what is it good
for? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was there. It was fun to see all the different things people were doing with Node besides just serving up HTML and JSON, basically. It's nice to see. I mean, people still are looking at Node as a web framework or web, you know, running thing instead of just an abstraction over I/O and, you know, more of a VM kind of situation. See, I mean, there's nothing that I can think of stopping somebody from writing like WX widget extensions and writing GUIs for Node apps, like actual Linux GUIs or something like that. I don't know. I don't know why you would want to do it like that versus just doing it in C or C++ anyway, but
JavaScript, baby. So you can do it in JavaScript.
Exactly. So I've got some things I'm kind of spiking out at work to kind of show, okay, this is a benefit of using Node for our services or for our web frameworks and yada, yada. I've also got some other, you know, kind of experiments that I'm doing. I think I'm going to give a presentation at work here called Scott's Crazy Experimental Lab, where I just talk about, you know, different things I'm trying to do. Like, well, one of the things that I thought of was, what if we took the MVC3 or the MVC4 drop, source drop, whenever it hits, fork it, rip out all the system.web stuff, and make it OWN compatible so that you could distribute existing MVC sites on top of web API standalone. Now, sure, you could say, oh, well, yeah, it's forked, so you have to try to, you know, keep up and merge the changes and whatever. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. That was kind of, you know, one of my crazy ideas. Because at that point, like 90% of our deployment and setup is IIS config. It's the same kind of boilerplate IIS config every time, but we still got to do it. So what if it just turned our MVC app into a service similar to Node? So all we have to do is just copy it, register the service, and start it.
Oh, yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Huh.
Is it worth forking MVC versus converting them to something that's already OWN compatible, like Nancy? I don't know.
Yeah, it does sound like a lot of work, though.
But yeah, it would be a lot of work, and because we did briefly look at, you know, what would it take to get ASP.NET MVC running on top of OWN at one point, and we determined that it's just you'd have to be Microsoft basically, because there's a lot of stuff in the guts to get it to work. But
maybe if you like slim down what you're covering, you know.
Yeah. See if you could, you know, how much do I really need? Can I just populate stuff like HTTP context from OWN and, you know, make it not so dependent on the HTTP listener and all that junk kind of in IIS? I don't know. So that's kind of one thing. I'm looking at different ways of doing connection strings for databases instead of having them in an app config or a machine config or text files called that we used in pre and Hibernate and all that, the
any files.
Data sources?
Oh, yeah.
Well, there are any files, yeah. You could make just a standalone ODBC data file or something that you could then pass around.
Yeah.
Thinking of doing a SQL config assembly so that it has the listings of the particular databases, IPs, usernames, passwords, whatever, compiled into an assembly that then gets mefed in by the app when it's deployed to a server. So suddenly you've decoupled the database config from the app so that the only thing that really knows about the database config is the app server. So you deploy an app to an app server, and this SQL connection assembly is sitting in the GAC or sitting somewhere where it's accessible, gets loaded up by the app, and it says, okay, so the machine is telling me, what I should be connecting to, what database I should use in this configuration. And I'm thinking of that mainly from a distributed data center or kind of cloud-centric approach, where you don't really know, at least not so much cloud, but distributed data center. So you may have to be installed in a data center in Poughkeepsie, or you may be installed in Tacoma. And, having those two, having to transform the web config to get the connection strings right would be kind of a pain. So if you just have those servers tell the app, hey, here's the information for the database connection. It's kind of a step removed from just doing it in the registry settings on those. But, there's other problems associated with storing connection strings in the registry. I thought this was a more interesting approach. Like I said, it's just an experiment.
That's driving me nuts now. I'm trying to remember the name of the file extension. It was a data source name, but I can't remember there was a file extension. Because I used to do those all the time. I would just create a test one on my desktop. So that I, and then connect to the thing, and then you'd have your connection string.
So that's what I've been doing at work. DSN, yes.
Yeah.
That's it. Kevin is awesome.
Oh, right. DSN.
Just obscure stuff that is totally worthless knowledge filling up the brain.
You aren't using DSN with your node code?
You need to, if you ever need to know QEMM command line switches.
We will, because Visual Studio is using up all the damn room. Need to run it in HiMem.
That's what this podcast needs, more sound effects.
That's true.
I can't believe that Skype does not have a soundboard so that I can plug in
sad
Arnold Schwarzenegger quotes from Commando and stuff.
Yeah.
Definitely sad trombone or even IT crowd quotes. Something.
Throwing a rim shot.
Right. Okay.
Should I just wrap it up?
Yes.
Okay. That concludes this episode of Herding Code. Thanks for listening, and tune in again for the next show.